Hey folks, this is Dean Friedman, and you're listening to Cat Tales.
You're listening to Cat Tales.
Hi, I'm Cat, and you're listening to Cat Tales. American singer-songwriter Dean Friedman first entered into the international pop consciousness in 1977 with his top 20 chart success of his infectious hit single, Ariel. And before anyone could attach the label One Hit Wonder, Dean scored again with the release of his follow-up album Well Wells of the Rocking Chair, and hit singles including Lucky Stars, Lydia, Rocking Chair, McDonald's Girl and Woman of Mine. Dean has since become known as a singer-songwriter par excellence and has composed and produced soundtracks for film and television, including most notably for the TV series starring Michael Elflick, Boone. Now he has a new album, American Lullaby, which touches on a broad range of topics from the pandemic, looming environmental disaster, racism, sexism, fractured politics, and a cultural war. This is The One with Dean Friedman. Thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. I'm so thrilled to be speaking to you. I really am.
Pleasure.
And it's afternoon for you, isn't it, over there in New York?
It is.
I'm over here in the UK. Yes. It's the evening. What's happening there with you at the moment?
Well, I would say it's probably similar to what's happening around the rest of the world, which is just as we were getting a sense of the possibility of returning to some kind of normal. This Delta variant has shooken things up once again.
Yeah.
And although, you know, for people that have been vaccinated, as I have, there's a greater sense of relief, but there's still an underlying sense of anxiety and concern about what's going to happen next. And, you know, it was only a week ago that we lost a really dear member, you know, family friend to COVID. So, you know, the idea that it's gone away is just false. And I only wish that the rest of my countrymen and women understood that fact.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, Dean. Do you know, it's affected so many people, hasn't it? And, do you know, there's still a proportion of society, certainly around here in the UK, and I know you've got the same thing in the US, who don't believe actually it's even real. And, do you know, I just think, how can you think that it's all just made up or a conspiracy to create something? I don't know what goes through people's mind, but you know, it's clearly touching so many people's lives. It's hard to believe that it's actually not real.
It is a puzzle. It's hard to fathom, but it's a reality that we're dealing with. And, you know, hopefully most of us will come out having survived, if a bit scarred by the experience. But we'll still have plenty to grapple with into the future. Having said all that, I remain optimistic and hopeful about our capacity to do better and to figure these things out. We'll see if that actually occurs.
Oh, I certainly hope so, don't you? I mean, we've got to have hope, haven't we, that there is a better future, and that humanity will work out all this stuff. It's a bit like global warming, isn't it? I know we've gone straight into a very, very hard conversation here, but you know what? It's these kind of things that are a sort of in our everyday life that is very easy to gloss over, isn't it? We've got fires in Greece going on. We've got flooding over in Europe. The whole world seems a little bit topsy-turvy at the minute for me.
It is indeed, and that's really what inspired me to sit down and write all the songs that are on this new album. And even though it's difficult material, I just was compelled to try and wrap my head around it just for myself, to try and process all the crazy things that have been going on. And but having said that, I still approach it, as is my habit, by trying to find, in many cases, some perspective to provide not just solace, but a little bit of humor to the proceedings. And so I make sure that it's leavened with an ample dose of humor and silliness, because I think those are crucial survival mechanisms, no matter what's facing you.
Oh, God.
And there is a lot to face.
That, you know, that is so true. And having listened to your new album, now the new album's American Lullaby, and I'm going to just say I've listened to the whole thing, and it was absolutely delightful. And the reason for that, I'm saying delightful is a beautiful word for me, because it gave me such pleasure listening to it. It brought a smile to my face. But at the same time, as you said there, you are really dealing with some very difficult issues. So it's like a little bit of a juxtaposition of the two things. And that was really quite remarkable that you've actually pulled that off. Did you intend to actually do that in the start of the writing process, or did it just come out that way because it's a typical Dean way of dealing with things?
Well, as I say, it was a daunting challenge, but it is my habit to try and address difficult topics in that way. And at the beginning, I adopted a format that felt familiar, which is how I wound up titling the song and the album American Lullaby. Mm-hmm. Reason being that if you think about it, there's this curious common denominator in lullabies in every culture around the world, no matter what country, no matter what tribe. All lullabies share this very strange attribute, which is that they're filled with frightening, terrible things that are going to happen to little children, but they do it in a soothing way. Even, you know, rock-a-bye baby on a treetop, when the wind blows, the cradle will rock. When the bough breaks, the cradle will fall. You know, here's this lullaby, you're trying to put this innocent child to sleep, and yet they're falling out of a tree with the cradle landing on their head.
Yeah.
And my only sort of way to interpret that is that it's a universal attempt by parents everywhere to provide critical information to the next generation, but not scare the hell out of them, so that they provide that critical information about the realities that they will face in the world, but in a comforting, soothing nursery rhyme or a sing-song lullaby, as they soothe them to sleep, so that they'll absorb what are essentially difficult messages, but absorb them with loving intent from their parents or the generation that's trying to raise them. So that's the approach I took to the whole album, which is that, yes, this is a lot of difficult subject matter. As you say, you know, the climate disaster is no longer looming. It's not pending anymore. It's here.
Yeah.
And all those issues I try to grapple with. But again, in my way. I don't want people running away screaming in horror. I want them to think about what's going on, so that they at least have the tools to move forward and try to deal with whatever's coming down the pike.
But, you know, you've summed it up so brilliantly there. I mean, that just so is just so eloquent, the way you've put that, about the fact a lullaby is capturing some very difficult things that are, you know, are the dangers in the world. But they're putting it in a lovely delivery, so actually it goes into the subconscious and is absorbed. And, you know, that's exactly what that album does. It is so beautifully written. It was incredible. It took me on that, I'm not even going to say a journey, because each of those songs were different messages, weren't they? But at the same time, they all of them have got a little element of humor, a little uplifting tilt to them, when the lyrics and the meaning behind them are actually quite stark.
Well, it was, a challenge, but, you know, I approached it earnestly and, you know, whatever tools and craft I've accumulated over the years. And, you know, with the sincere desire, really, to understand these things myself.
Yeah.
Because when you write a song, it forces you to think about what you're writing about, to try and wrap your head around it. And all these events of the last 6 years really have really blown my mind. And I know I'm not alone in that regard. Mm-hmm. But rather than, you know, make believe everything's fine and none of these things happened. I wanted to face them and find some way to address them so that, again, so that I was prepared to move forward, but not in an ignorant way.
That's just wonderful, really. What makes me feel is that it inspired me really to go, do you know what, I need to dig deeper into each of those different issues. I mean, though, you've got various different things on the album there, haven't you? From everything from, you know, America and your guns, which is very different from the UK, and that sort of kind of love affair that you've got going on there, and through to some of the political issues that you've had in the US, and of course there's COVID in there as well, and all those kind of things. I mean, that's actually quite a lot of topics to be covering in one single album. Was it intentional for you to go, well, do you know what, this has taken like 6 years to produce or whatever, I'm going to take everybody on that journey through that time and capture those elements?
It was intentional. At the same time, there are some songs on the album that I specifically wrote to address really the mental health of my, you know, myself and my community and my listeners, because it's one of those things not often spoken about. But there has been everyone on the planet has experienced trauma. I mean, there are difficult times all over the place, but these last few years and the pandemic in particular has impacted every single soul on this planet. And aside from the health aspects of it, the physical aspects of it, it's been debilitating emotionally and mentally in terms of people's mental health. And it can't be overstated, because it's usually understated. And so I wanted to make sure that there were songs on this album that addressed that. So there's my song, you know, slowly getting back into the swing of things, acknowledging that sometimes if you take a physical hit and you're depressed and unenthused, that it takes a while to motivate yourself to reengage in the world. And of course, I do it on a ukulele, and it's in the context of a silly song, but it's got a serious message. And I hope it's inspirational. Another song is I Wish You Joy. And it has that same intent, which is that, you know, sometimes you just can't kid yourself into how things really are. Sometimes life sucks.
Yes, exactly.
But even during those difficult times, it's still important for us to maintain a thread of hope and faith and the possibility of healing and you know, recovering from that difficulty. And in part, it's simply a matter of kind of in the midst of trouble, opening your eyes and trying to recognize the blessings that we still have in our lives and with our loved ones and family and with, you know, this planet that we've been gifted with. And so I do try and consciously, even though I set out with the initial intent, as I continue to write songs and record the album, I was conscious of trying to balance the gloom and doom with that hope and faith and our capacity to do better and to recover and to embrace our potential and to love our the folks around us and even people that don't look like us. Because usually there are instincts that despots like to exacerbate based on fear. And fear is never a great way to operate your life and life choices.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you fret now, don't you cry. It's an American lullaby. Manifest destiny's a lie. It's an American lullaby. Half moon sailing through the night. Crack of a musket fired, first light. Always keep your powder dry. Rest your head and dreams you'll fly. It's an American lullaby. Blaze a trail across the sky. It's an American lullaby. Drinking gourd will point the way. Stealth by night and sleep by day. Beg like Joe, you can rely. It's an American lullaby. Restless dreams we shall defy. But TV pundits prophesy. Best laid plans have gone awry. It's an American lullaby. He said, I cannot tell a lie. My heart and hope to die. Still won't look you in the eye. It's an American lullaby. Close your eyes now, sleep is nigh. It's an American lullaby. Cross the shallows, do or die. It's an American lullaby. Headlights shining in the dark. Coyotes howl, the bloodhounds bark. You can hear the angels. It's an American lullaby. Human kindness in short supply. It's an American lullaby. Folks, this is Dean Friedman, and you're listening to Cat Tales.
So all in all, I find it a very uplifting album, and I think what you've described there, it coins it so beautifully. It's wonderful. And of course, it's your ninth studio album, isn't it, that you've released there? That's a lot of music that you've produced over your, 40 plus years career, haven't you? How do you actually maintain that momentum? Because that's actually quite difficult. I mean, I can see where this album's come from, because it coins that moment in time. do you actually just get inspired by what's going on around you, or how do you actually approach it all for each individual album?
Well, to be honest, I have two parallel motivations. And I'll preface it by an anecdote that's repeated about the great singer-songwriter Cole Porter, where someone asked him where he gets his inspiration. And his answer was that when the phone rings and it's a director looking for a song, that's his motivation.
I love it.
And as a, you know, as a songwriter that views what I do as part inspiration and part craft, I definitely sympathize with that reaction. In my case, there's no director calling me on the phone looking for a show tune, but I have been crowdfunding my albums since 2001 when I first crowdfunded my album, The Treehouse Journals. I was sitting in my treehouse and I thought, well, I got a lot of songs. I'd like to record them, but I got to upgrade my studio and I got to pay musicians. So I wrote an email to all the folks on my email list saying, look, if you order this album in advance, I'll deliver an album.
Yeah.
And I was a little worried that folks were going to say, oh, Dean, why don't you get a proper job?
Yeah.
And some people actually wrote me just that, to my chagrin. But enough people were supportive of the idea, and for that I was grateful. And I was able to crowdfund the album and deliver it. And I've been crowdfunding my albums ever since, including the most recent one. And bearing in mind that this was 8 years before Kickstarter ever existed. The band Marillion had done it just prior to my doing it online. But it's what's made it possible for me to continue recording and touring. So I had crowdfunded a new album about 18 months ago, and I was late delivering it, and I started feeling really guilty and a very strong sense of responsibility to deliver what I'd promised to my, you know, my fan base, the folks who actually support my efforts. And so it was a combination of that, my determination to fulfill my obligation to do a new album, but very much influenced by current events, by all the crazy stuff that was going around. And so it crystallized for me, and I at some point understood what I wanted to do, the kind of album that I wanted to make. And then all that was left was to write the songs, record them, and then try to find a way to get them heard. And so I'm slowly but surely doing just that.
Oh, that's fabulous. All that was left was to write them. And that's the hardest bit in the whole process, as far as I can see. But you may feel differently. You may go, actually, that's the easy bit for me, just writing them. It's everything else that goes with it.
Well, it's a process. It's very often very painful and scary in the middle of it. But the results, when you're finally finished with it, are really gratifying, and especially gratifying when people have such a very strong and positive response.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about, isn't it? I love the idea that you've crowdfunded it, because what you're talking about there, when you first started that back in, 2002, when you released the Treehouse Journals. I love the fact that you're in the treehouse, by the way. That's really fascinated me for a start. But going back to the crowdfunding, it's amazing that, you know, in those days, that was very... It was quite revolutionary in those days, wasn't it? And I remember, you mentioned Marillion there. I remember when they came out with the crowdfunding, that a lot of people felt like, oh my goodness, you want money to actually do this before I've even done it. Nowadays, we actually look at it and think, well, do you know, of course that's a way of funding it. Of course, we don't even think twice. But it was actually, at that time when you did that album, quite different, wasn't it? Different to approach.
It was, and part of it is the process of explaining to your audience an alternate means of supporting music. because the traditional means of supporting all the arts, all creative endeavors, which are top down, which are pretty dismissive of the people that actually listen to the results, is really based on the habits of a music industry that basically cannibalizes its young. You know, and that's, I know, a horrific image, but that's what happens. It's an industry that is filled with abuse, and you know, the financial disadvantaging of the artists that provide the very content that the business is based on. And that's really not changed. The only thing that's changed since I started out in terms of record industry abuse is that there are even more players now that are taking advantage of the artists, specifically, you know, the DSPs, entities like Spotify and YouTube and Apple and Amazon. And much as I am a user of all of those as well, there's still a disparity and an inequity in terms of how they compensate their artists. Mm. And that needs to change, and it only will change by people speaking up about it, as awkward as it may sometimes feel. But I guess part of it is an educational, a learning process, because in today's world, and really, you know, since the advent of radio, music has always been a loss leader and not valued for what it's worth and the effort that goes into making it. The reason music has always been a loss leader, and the music still remains a loss leader, is because big manufacturers are selling televisions and stereos and washing machines and appliances and iPhones and iPads and smartphones and whatnot. They're selling very expensive electronic equipment for thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, they throw in a music subscription. And they can do that because they're not paying the artist very much. Anyway, it's easy to go on a rant. I don't mean to.
No, I totally understand. Many people I speak to say exactly the same thing, Dean. And it's just something that needs to be addressed in the industry, isn't it? Because it's stifling the young, you know, the young talent that's coming through, because there's just going to be no industry left, is there, for them to make a living out of?
Well, hopefully. There will be enough of a popular movement to correct some of those injustices. But in the meantime, crowdfunding is a unique way to bypass the whole issue because I remain unsigned. No major label has knocked on my door in 40 years. Yeah. And yet I continue writing songs and I continue making records and I continue touring. And it's all by the good graces of my enthusiastic and loyal audience to whom I am forever grateful.
Yeah, that's it. At the end of the day, they're the people, aren't they, that you're doing it all for. And I think that must really, you know, make you want to go out there and do it again when you see people face to face. And we've missed that, haven't we, over the last couple of years. But at least you're actually going to be going out there again, I understand. So that's got to be something to look forward to.
I do indeed. Well, I do have live dates that are confirmed and on sale now in the gig section of my website, deanfriedman.com, that start kick off next year, April 2022 in the UK. And you can get tickets for them as we speak. And unless a giant meteor crashes into the face of the moon and precludes air travel, I'm determined to pack my bags, grab my guitar, get on a plane, and hit the road running. But in the meantime, I've been doing a monthly webcast, a Zoomcast, from my home studio where I am right now.
I have seen it. Amazing. That's great. You can catch it on YouTube, can't you?
You can. It's the last Sunday of every month. But, you know, at first I was skeptical because I thought, well, you know, you can't achieve the intimacy of a live gig. And while that is true, there's this weird intimacy that's virtual, which I've really grown to appreciate and I find really appealing, because in one of these Zoom events, you know, in a live gig, I can usually see the faces of people in the first couple of rows and how they're reacting to the music. But that's it. Further back, it gets blurry and dark. But in a Zoom event, I can see everybody right into their homes. Nothing could be more intimate than that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can see their pets jumping up and down on their laps, or I can see what they're snacking on, or their family wandering in and out of the frame.
Yeah.
And the audience can see each other, too. That's unique. In a live gig, they can only see the back of people's heads. But in one of my Zoom concerts, people can see everybody else and chat with them while I'm singing without interrupting the proceedings. It does have this strange virtual intimacy about it that I, as I say, I've grown to appreciate. And we always have a lot of fun.
Do you know, that's a really great way of describing it, because you've always thought that, oh, you can't quite capture it with Zoom. It's not quite the same as being in a live event. And okay, you may not have the same kind of atmosphere, but what you've described there is some benefits that you don't have in a live event. So do you think when you start to get back doing it in front of people again, and we, let's say, go back to the new normal, whatever that turns out to be, as you've described in your album there, do you think that actually you'll carry on doing some stuff on Zoom just to have that different aspect that you've created so far?
Definitely, because I enjoy it. Aside from the fact that I can just kind of wander down a few steps into the basement,
yeah,
and do a concert, that's certainly beats a lot of the schlepping around that I do.
But
there is something about having an instantaneous connection with people all over the planet. You know, when I do a Zoom concert, there'll be people you know, at 9 in the morning in Hawaii and 12 noon in Los Angeles, and you know, maybe 2 p.m. in Louisiana, or 3 p.m. in New York, and then 8 p.m. in London, and who knows what time in Australia. But all these people from all over the planet and almost every continent are able to tune in and share that common experience. And it really does foster this community sense, which it's kind of unique.
I just wanted to ask you, just going back to your album, your new album, American Lullaby, have you got a favourite on there? Because I would love to feature some of your tracks, and I just would like to know which ones you think would actually summarise perhaps Dean Friedman as you are now.
Well, you know, Kat, that's a tough one, because songs are like little kids. And you love them all.
Yeah.
It's just that some are better behaved than others.
I love that.
And so I feel that way about the new album. Although that I do acknowledge that the title track has been getting a lot of really positive and powerful feedback as people are introduced it for the first time. Mm-hmm. And but having said that, there are, you know, there are a lot of fun tracks and some silly tracks and some serious tracks. If you were to choose two, I guess I'd pick the first two tracks, because they do complement each other in a way.
Yeah.
One is very serious and haunting. That's American Lullaby.
Yeah.
But I digital. Made sure to follow it up with something that was a little more how do I put it? A little more lighthearted. It's called Too Much Stuff, and you could view it as a metaphor of our obsessive consumerism and the perils of capitalism, but it's also really about sort of a personality trait that my family and friends seem to share. Where you tread the line carefully between being an astute collector of artifacts and objects to art, or being an outright hoarder.
That's
no
yeah.
restraint on
no.
their things that they gather and collect. Too Much Stuff expresses that very dilemma, and it does it with a lighthearted spirit, and it seems to always make people smile.
I got too much stuff,
I've got way more shoes than it's possible to use. I got too much stuff. I've got a myriad of devices and way too many vices. I've got no recollection of ever starting this collection, and I guess my innate curiosity combined with sheer fastidiosity reached escape velocity to determine my ultimate direction. Upon reflection, I can't ignore my obvious predilection for too much stuff. I've got multiple containers full of colanders and strainers. I got too much stuff. I've got various vessels filled with mortars and pestles. It's a real mess, I'll tell you. I probably started as a child, collecting bottle caps and stamps, gradually over time, grew to keyboards, guitars, and amps. I never saw myself as a hoarder with an order disorder, but after the court order, I concluded I was clearly on the border. I got too much stuff. I admit it's almost comical. It's certainly not economical. I got too much stuff. Once tried to keep a chronicle, storage fees alone were astronomical. My friend said it's a symptom, some deep-seated neurosis. So I went to a shrink for a professional psych diagnosis. I said to him, Doc, give it to me straight. What's my likely prognosis? He scheduled me for 52 weeks of hypnosis. I got too much stuff. My basement is cluttered with things best left unuttered. I got too much stuff. I recommend you avoid the attic, especially if you're asthmatic. Now, some may be somewhat skeptical, but everything's collectible. Pardon my inelegance, I don't mean to impugn your intelligence. Stop by one afternoon, you'll see my entire bedroom is strewn with autographed production stills from a Bugs Bunny cartoon, plus my prize signed photograph of Reese Witherspoon and the actual raccoon cap worn by Daniel Boone, and maybe Davy Crockett, plus this gold-plated locket I keep in my pocket along with this watch. Keeps really good time, so don't knock it. I got too much stuff. My house is a mess. It's really quite stressful. I got too much stuff. I tried to create order, but I've been unsuccessful. I got tchotchkes and doodads and trinkets and knickknacks, plus the world's largest collection of fruit-flavored Tic Tacs, novelties and mementos and assorted paraphernalia, plus a stuffed duck-billed platypus all the way from Australia. I got too much stuff. I got too much stuff. To the brim with packages of Slim Jims. I got too much stuff. I'm stacked to the rafters with glasses from Lens Crafters. I try not to grumble, but my life's an absolute jumble. I take one step in any direction and I stumble. I need to minimize and reorganize and downsize and revise and optimize and prioritize everything that implies. I got too much stuff. I've got 62 cases of marshmallow fluff. I got too much stuff. And believe me, that's way, way more than enough. I'm stuffed to the gills with hammers and drills and posters and pamphlets and flyers and handbills. I can't help it. Categorize, classify, and collate by color and size, by texture and weight. I pray for recovery, but it's probably too late. I got too much stuff. This is Dean Friedman, and you're listening to Cat Tales.
I just like to think back to your vast career that you've got going on there, over all the lifetime in music that you've actually delivered there. Are there any moments that really stand out for you, Dean, that you would go, that one moment in time was maybe the most important, or the one that moves people the most? Or, you know, is there something that in your career that you think that was it?
Well, you know, it's strange. Every audience is different. Every performance has its own character and quality. And there's also the knowledge that how I experience a performance from stage might be diametrically different to how the audience experiences it. You know, sometimes you come off stage and you think, oh, that was a lousy gig. And then everyone afterwards says, oh, that was the best gig we ever saw. Mm-hmm. And so there's this sometimes a different perspective, and everyone's certainly entitled to their own perspective on that as well. And the opposite can occur too. But it's funny, when you asked that question, as I thought back thinking, well, what, you know, kind of performance made an impact on me? And, you know, different ones come to mind, but a curious one really just sort of settled into my brain as I was trying to come up with an honest response. And it's that after I was dropped by my label and found myself pretty much in the music business wilderness, and this was before the internet, where it was not, I didn't have the capacity that I do now to reach my audience and to set up gigs and tour independent of the industry itself. There was a time, you know, during the 80s where I was very much left to my own devices as a songwriter and a performer. But my kids were in nursery school. And so, you know, when you're a singing parent, inevitably you're invited to sing a bunch of songs for little kids.
Yeah.
And so I found myself sitting with my guitar on the floor of a nursery school filled with, you know, about a dozen 5- and 6-year-old kids. And I have a whole bunch of silly kid songs that I started writing as soon as my kids were born. And I sort of had an epiphany, which was that playing for these little kids and seeing the expressions on their faces and the way in which they soaked up every word of the performance and that they approached the performance with no preconceptions and no prejudice. They just wanted to be entertained, and it required that you entertain them. You couldn't lose your focus or concentration for a moment because they could feel it. But other than that, they're not judgmental at all. They have no expectations. They just, you know, want to hear what you have to say. And I realized at that moment that it didn't really matter the size of your audience or the kind of venue you were playing, that the essence of all this art was to share it with whoever is up to listening, and that the satisfaction I got as a writer and as a performer was no different in some respects, even purer than occasions in the past where I've stood up in front of an audience, you know, in a big concert where there might be 5,000, 10,000 people listening. Yeah. Now, there is a charge and an excitement that you get walking in front of a big crowd. But again, the essence of sharing a performance is not really contingent on the size of the crowd. If you're paying attention and if you're, you know, sort of honest with what it is you're trying to do in terms of sharing the songs and expressing yourself, you know, just a little gathering on a carpeted floor has the same quality, and in some cases even more so, because there's no pretense. You're just sharing an expression, and if the folks sitting there, even if they're, you know, really short, if it means something to them, well, that's what it's all about. That's what's satisfying, and that's what you know, that's the reason you do it.
Oh, do you know, that's so adorable. I can see their little faces in my mind, and I get straight away when you're talking there, I can see them hanging on every word that you're saying. And at that moment in time, in a way, that's even more influential, isn't it, for that little mind that's absorbing all that stuff. And you're having more influence on maybe that little mind than you possibly do in other areas when you're, you know, people who are later in life talk, you know, watching your shows. That's just wonderful. I'm really, yeah, it's brought a tear to my eye, actually, as I'm sitting here thinking of it. It's beautiful. Oh, dear, that's lovely. I'm pleased you've said that. Well, I must say it's been a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you so much for giving up some of your afternoon to speak to me.
A pleasure. Oh, and have you. A great rest of your day.
Yes, and you. Thank you so much for your time. Enjoy it. All right. Okay. You take care. Speak soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Cattails with me, Cat, and my guest today, Dean Friedman. The tracks featured are American Lullaby and Too Much Stuff from Dean's album American Lullaby, which is available in stores and on digital streaming and downloads. To hear Dean performing the album, tune into his regular Dean Zine live stream webcasts, and he will be performing a 40-city concert tour from April 2022. Visit deanfriedman.com for more information. And to listen to this and other tales, visit cattails.co.uk. See you next time.
You've been listening to